Grew up going to travelogues with my Aunt Lil at the Playhouse Theater here in Winnipeg, AKG's World Adventure Tours. I think about every 2 weeks, there was a different travelogue, always shot in 16mm film. It would have music and sound effects, but the narration was always supplied live, and it was kind of charming.
To the University of Manitoba's Icelandic Radio Journal, a continuing series documenting interviews and fragments engaging with Icelandic culture. In this edition of the journal, we are joined by distinguished Canadian filmmaker Guy Madden. Guy also teaches at the University of Manitoba.
Guy, what does it mean to stand in front of your audience and narrate your film live, as you did in Toronto and in Winnipeg? How did it bring the work to life?
I'm getting kind of hooked on having live elements in my movies. It wasn't just with my Winnipeg that had live element, namely just me narrating it live on some occasions. Maybe I've done it 10 times in different cities in the world. Sydney, Berlin, Paris, London, Winnipeg, Toronto. I can't remember where else right now. But before that, the feature I made before that, Brand Upon the Brain, was a real sort of live extravaganza. It had an orchestra, it had three sound effects artists, it had a narrator, not me, Isabella Rossellini usually, and a number of guest narrators, and a singer. And I just noticed, it is easy for me to notice the difference because I've always been a filmmaker that's had a relatively high walkout ratio. There's a lot of people that just don't like my movies. Luckily, there's some people that really do, but I've always been a bit of an audience divider. But I couldn't help but notice that no one was walking out of Brand Upon the Brain. That, in fact, quite to the contrary, it was almost as if everyone shifted forward one row, or at least leaned forward more. I think it was half in anticipation. I think they could sense my fear that something was going to go wrong, that this crazy high wire act that was really just being held together with spit and gum was going to just fall apart and that everything would go wrong. And quite often the movies got off to such halting technological false starts that that a disaster was almost promised to the viewers. And so, of course, they'd be watching half hoping the film would succeed and half hoping the film would fail. You know, being guaranteed happiness one way or the other. And when the film worked, it really worked well, and I noticed that my terror turned into a great thirst for one beer after, and boy, did that beer taste great after the show was over each night. And I got hooked on the adrenaline, too. Just that much theater. It wasn't really theater, it was just film still, but with a pinch of theater in it, and it felt great. So I knew the best chance of making this documentary about Winnipeg reach people properly would be if I presented it with a live narrator. This wasn't such an odd or original idea. I grew up going to travelogues with my Aunt Lil at the Playhouse Theater here in Winnipeg, AKG's World Adventure Tours. I think about every 2 weeks. There was a different travelogue, always shot in 16mm film. It would have music and sound effects, but the narration was always supplied live, and it was kind of charming. And I'm just always looking for some sort of gimmick, some sort of hook to trick the audience into staying in their seats, because it hurt when people just got up and went to the bathroom and never came back all those previous years. I thought, okay, I can present this documentary I've been commissioned to make about Winnipeg as if it were a travelogue, and maybe it'll be charming. I didn't want to be the one doing the narrating, and I argued hard with my producer and with the commissioning executive producer at the documentary channel for someone else to pretend to be me, like a trained actor with a great voice. I wanted Lorne Greene or James Mason or something, but all of my choices were dead anyway, so my arguments were dead in the water, and they said, no, there's enough, so many strange myths about Winnipeg in here already that if we don't really use the real you, the movie will become a complete fiction, or be perceived as one anyway. So it had to be me. And I really enjoyed it. I'm taking a long time to answer your question, but it's the fullest answer I can give you. And what happened was, well, there is a studio recorded version of my narration, and that's what's on the DVD. But I get a chance to adjust it each time I perform the live version. I can feel the audience's involvement. I can feel how little or how much they're leaning forward in their seats. And if they're not leaning into the movie enough, I can sort of crank up my narration a little bit. And if someone does get up to go to the bathroom, I can literally fix them with a stare, as if to say, hey, you better be coming back in about 90 seconds. Yeah. And, you know, and I'm not thrilled. You know, you had plenty of time to go to the bathroom before. And what are you doing going now? Get your prostate checked. You know, that sort of thing. So I could really kind of almost guarantee no walkouts. Only one person out of the 2,000 people that crammed into the Walker, or the Burton Cummings Theater here in Winnipeg, walked out. And that was Gary Yates, a local filmmaker, who just made a point of, I guess he hates my movies. I don't know. I don't take it too personally. I was, but I couldn't help but notice, since I am, you know, it's a live performance and I am live, and there's a person right there getting up with a disgusted look on his face, yawning and turning on his heel and walking out. It kind of just fired me up.
Yeah.
I didn't bother cranking up my narration at that point, urging him to come back. As a matter of fact, I waited till he was out of the room and then cranked up my narration for the rest of the people who remained. It felt really good. But in other words, it creates an exchange between me and the audience. And while I'm no performer, and it sure as hell beats sitting there helplessly while you're watching your movie not reacting well with an audience and not being able to do anything about it. You can actually do something about it. You can try, anyway. And the movie may still bomb. Luckily enough, it hasn't seemed to. But you can do something about it. It feels great.
That's great. So, in other words, there's some kind of immediacy when there's a
absolutely live narration. Absolutely, and which is why I've only watched the movie once without myself narrating it. I feel helpless because there's parts of the narration I would do differently now, and I can't because it was all recorded, mm-hmm. and so I just let it go like the rest of my movies. It's not healthy to watch your own stuff over and over and over again anyway. Maybe revisit it once every 10 or 15 years or something if you want to feel uncomfortable, because you're such a different person 10 years down the road.
I also, I've read recently that when in Paris in October, that Isabella Rossellini, she narrated one of your films.
Yeah, Brand Upon the Brain. Yeah. The beauty of silent films, Brand Upon the Brain is technically a silent film, but it has all sorts of acoustic landscaping, you know, sort of everything but the kitchen sink has been thrown at its soundscaping. I mentioned that earlier. But the beauty about silent films is that they traveled the world so well. All you had to do was cut out the intertitle cards, the printed ones, and cut in new intertitle cards in whatever language of the country you're exporting to. So you could just get a French or Spanish or German translation and cut them in, and all of a sudden the movie's the same. Didn't have to worry about dubbing or subtitles or anything like that. So when I heard that the film was going to be playing as part of a huge Guy Maddin retrospective at the Pompidou, but the Brand Upon the Brain event was actually staged at the Théâtre de l'Odéon, which is commissioned by Marie Antoinette. This is a beautiful theater. She commissioned a movie theater somehow. I guess she could have, you know, she's very prescient. This beautiful opera house. And I thought this is going to be worth the extra money to get to shoot all, to get a translation, shoot French intertitles. The French language is so important to the French. You know, it's this just the crystalline purity of French. And I just, there was no way I was going to present a film to them in English, even though many of the people in the house would speak English. There was no way I was going to present a film to them in English without, you know, making a gesture towards them. So one of the component parts is a little bit of narration sprinkled throughout the movie, an interlocutor, as they called them back in the silent days when a narrator was employed. Luckily, Isabella speaks Italian, English, and French with equal fluency, whatever that is. It's kind of a mellifluous sort of mixture of all three languages, with some Swedish thrown in as well. A Swedish accent she picked up from her mother. I don't think she speaks any Swedish. A Swedish tonality or a temperature or something, I don't know, whatever it is. It sounds like she's speaking the same language when she's speaking English, French, and Italian. It's just Isabella, and it sounds so beautiful. She is like an extra musician in the orchestra pit. And so it's quite a beautiful, and the crowds really love her for some reason. I guess, I don't know, she's just so classy. She's just a classy broad, and she is so gracious. But she's also so approachable and friendly, and she's so bawdy, and she's so little girlish, and she's always going to be her daddy's little girl, and she's always going to be a supermodel, and she's always going to be film royalty and stuff like that. So for her fame and goodwill is buttressed from so many different directions, and so the crowd really loves her, and it's great sharing a stage with her, introducing her. En français, that was a disaster for me.
How did that go?
My French, I feel terrible. As a Canadian in France, as a Canadian who doesn't speak any French, I feel so ashamed because I know how important the language is. But this is one example of where it's worse being a Canadian than being an American abroad. I almost felt like putting an American flag on my backpack while traveling around in France, because they know enough about Canada there to know that you should be bilingual. But it's just a setup, because if I were bilingual, then they'd just make fun of my Quebecois accent anyway. They're ruthless. So what I did was memorize with understanding, but it still sounded closer to a phonetic memorization. An elaborate introduction to the evening, introduced all the elements of the soundscape, the sound effects artists, the orchestra members, thanked everybody involved, Isabella, of course, the singer, Davoul. And it was, as one good friend I could trust to tell the truth said, and she is bilingual and from France, she said, "You made yourself a perfect spectacle of pity up there." So I think it was worth the effort and the humiliation just to make the gesture. And I don't mind, because I certainly respect, you know, it's take an idiot not to figure out how important the language is in France. So, and I was just so grateful and really beautifully treated there. I have to say, it sounds conceited, but the evening was a triumph. You know, it really felt great. I've never felt better about an evening featuring one of my pictures.
I understand that you travel extensively and also split your time between Winnipeg and Toronto. What are your thoughts on existing in more than one place?
I feel pretty lucky. It's taken some time to settle in. For the longest time, I felt I should spend more time in Toronto because my daughter lived there from about the age of 9 till she was 18, and I felt I should spend more time there. But I wasn't making much money in those days, and I could afford to live in Winnipeg better, and I could make films more cheaply here. But I did spend a lot of time and money going to Toronto, just commuting there, sleeping on people's couches, spending time with my daughter whenever I could. I spent summers with her, and I would spend falls there, but just sort of, you know, couch surfing. And so now, finally, that one of the great things that this job at the university I've gotten through the Icelandic department has enabled me to afford renting an apartment there, which I sublet out you know, about 8 months of the year, but I spend 4 months of the year there and hang out with my daughter. And she's grown up now, though, and even has given me I have a granddaughter now. She's had a daughter. She's given her boyfriend a daughter and me a granddaughter. And I love hanging out with them. I usually go there during the spring semester. And then I have a family home that I like to spend as much time at as possible in Gimli, Manitoba, the capital of New Iceland.
Yeah.
My beloved Loni Beach, Icelandic for lagoon, Loni. Of course, my Icelandic accent is even worse than my French one. I'm ashamed to say. But that's another question altogether. I kind of love having three different homes because it took me a long time to warm to Toronto, but I finally do feel like I'm at home in there when I'm there. But it is just for a few months a year. And I kind of like the feeling of waking up and trying to figure out where I am for the first few seconds. And I have routines in each of my three homes. And I'm just a renter in both Winnipeg and Toronto, and our family owns the cottage, so it's not like this is some wealthy thing, but I sure do feel lucky. Yeah, it's not like I'm, you know, John McCain with multiple large houses, yeah, things like that. And I really want to scale down on my travel. It breaks up work momentum. It breaks up my daydreaming. It's broken up fitness regimens, and I have trouble staying healthy and focused traveling as much as I do. Plus, there's just all that time spent sitting on airplanes too, and eating airplane food on transatlantic flights and things. So, and just wasting days fighting through the fog of jet lag, and I don't really like it that much. So I've been I'm finally in a position where I feel that I've gotten a nice enough reputation and it has some momentum of its own that I don't need to go out on a grassroots campaign and press flesh and kiss babies quite so much. So I used to travel out of an obligation to myself to spread the word about my films, but now I think I can afford to say no a little bit and rest and do daydreaming and work and read, and then hang with my family, hang with my friends, hang with my muses.
A passage from your book, From the Atelier Tovar, refers to the mixing of cultures, mm-hmm. to you reading some of your film reviews to your family and having them translated into Icelandic and then from Icelandic back.
Yeah.
and you talked a little bit about the change in the meaning.
Yeah. Well, I used to have them do that to scripts, even. Some of my short movie scripts I would have translated and then back. And now I use Google Translator to create language mischief with the stuff I'm playing with. It's kind of fun translating things into... Icelandic isn't all that readily available, I imagine, on Google Translator. I haven't tried it. Maybe I should. But since I no longer use elderly Icelanders... sort of entrenched at Bettelstadter. The ones I used to use have passed away, alas. One of the, Bertna still calls me Wadin because of some Google translation that I got a review. I could tell it was a positive review from Germany once, but I translated it into English, and the computer translated my name even as, as man Wadin or something like that instead of Guy Madden. And and so Bertna to this day just calls me Wadin or just Wad. And I kind of like the playfulness of it. It seems like something my God, I'm so lucky to be able to call him friend. John Ashbery, the American poet, was once so excited to find a typing school typewriter with no letters on any of the keys in the store, and I think he wanted to try typing poems with these things and sort of making things stick and just going with the mistakes. And he himself has transcribed a Rin Tin Tin movie screenplay into a play for humans. I've just read it, actually. It's called The Compromise. It's incredible. And just the idea of what happens, what changes in a translation. He then heavily brocaded and altered this thing to make it seem like a real play, and you'd never suspect it was a Rin Tin Tin movie, but I think these are wonderful little irritants or conceits that you can plant in them in the middle of the hardworking oyster to see what kind of pearl comes out. And so I do like playing with translation of things.
Thank you very much, Guy, for talking with me today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks. And good luck to everyone out there in Iceland.
This edition has been brought to you by Guy Madden, Andrew McGilvery, and the Department of Icelandic, University of Manitoba. Thanks for tuning in.